I do not know whether any of you must regularly preach children's sermons. Any of you? Well, I'll give you one. I thought of it this afternoon as we had this marvelous hike on the trail. This minister said to the boys and girls in his congregation, "Now I'm going to tell you about one of God's creatures, and I want you to see if you can guess what it is. It's a little furry animal with a big bushy tail that stores nuts for the winter. Do any of you know what that is?" A soldier, I don't know. He said, "What do you think it is?" She said, "It sounds like a squirrel, but I bet it's Jesus." I wanted to make a couple preliminary comments before I address my theme tonight to respond to how President Hardern was drawing me into the conversation this morning. The models that I have come to think of as the ways in which we understand ourselves, I have been trying to articulate three models. One is utilitarianism, which I think is what he meant, that I mean the same thing as President Hardern meant by scientific, technological progress and rationalism. And the alternative to that is transcendentalism, which I think is what he means by all of these popular manifestations of religious experience. The people with whom I talk mostly seem to think that those are the alternatives we have. Either a utilitarianism, which boils down to a works righteousness, or a transcendentalism, which settles for a withdrawal from history. Now, the third paradigm, which is the one I think we have to work at and what I've been trying to talk about, is covenantal historical, which wants to avoid the pitfalls of both utilitarianism and transcendentalism. And I understand Deuteronomy to be a tradition that tries to articulate that third paradigm for understanding ourselves as persons of faith. When I said that what Deuteronomy at the boundary affirms that we have alternatives, I didn't mean to suggest that as a descriptive statement about what the city will permit. I meant that to be a confessional statement that the alternative offered to us by Scripture is not an alternative that the city will permit, but we may choose it. That alternative has to do with speaking and hearing, with promising and vowing, and finally it has to do with dying and rising. And the language of the city, if I understand it, is opposed to speaking and hearing and promising and vowing and dying and rising. And that, I believe, is the question before us. The second preliminary comment that I wanted to make had to do with President Hardern's assertion that he didn't happen to have any lectures available on that, and so I wanted you to know how I had arrived at these particular themes. I mean, I don't mean to be defensive, but when I started thinking about what kinds of prophetic themes would be useful to pursue, I thought centrally of Deuteronomy 18, in which it is said that I will send a prophet like Moses to you. So I got to thinking about what would a prophet do. A prophet would do the Mosaic things. And in the history of the traditions of Israel, as Martin Note and Gerhard von Rod have laid them out, of the five basic themes of Israel's faith, the center three are the three Moses themes: Exodus, wilderness, and Sinai. Those are the three things that Moses did, and they're the only three things he did. So that any prophet who comes after, who does the Moses thing, I believe, must lead his people out of slavery, must feed his people in the wilderness, and must take them to the Mount of Covenant. So that's how I wanted to lay that out, and I will pursue part of that with you in these times we have together. Now, what I am going to do tonight reminded me of a story I heard of a Baptist preacher. I assume there are no Baptists here or ex-Baptists, but there was this Baptist preacher who always preached, and I also thought of this after the marvelous worship service we had this morning. He always preached about water baptism, and his people just got tired of hearing about water baptism, so they said, "Would you please preach about something else?" He said, "You give me a text, I'll preach on it." They gave him the text from 1 Kings 19 about Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel. And even good Baptist sermons have 3 points. More stories, but 3 points. So he said, "I have 3 points from this text tonight. The first point is where Elijah ran from. And the second point is where Elijah ran to. And the third point is some random thoughts on water baptism." Now, I have some random thoughts about the boundary tonight. I have been wanting to suggest that if the church is to do its ministry in the city, where indeed it must be done if it is to be done, it will be necessary for the church to return to the boundary, to re-enter its memory, to receive again the power to be on Kadosh. When I looked in Deuteronomy to see what they did when they got to the boundary, what I want to talk about tonight is that, first of all, the preacher at the boundary, whether it is the first generation of Israel in the land or whether it is Josiah's generation in the 7th century gone to the boundary of Deuteronomy, the first thing the preacher talked about was the Exodus event, so that's what I want to talk about. Like this, Deuteronomy 6, verse 21, "We were Pharaoh's slaves in Egypt, and Yahweh brought us out with a mighty hand, and Yahweh showed signs and wonders, great and grievous against Egypt and against Pharaoh and against all his household before our eyes. And he brought us out from there." Like this in Deuteronomy 7:8, "It is because Yahweh loves you that Yahweh brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." Or like this in Deuteronomy 11, verse 2, "Consider the discipline of Yahweh your God, his greatness, his mighty hand, and his outstretched arm, his signs and his deeds, which he did in Egypt to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and to all his land, and what he did to the army of Egypt, to their horses and to their chariots, how he made the water of the Red Sea overflow them as they pursued after you, and how the Lord has destroyed them to this day." What the preacher in Deuteronomy means to do is to transport the new generation back into the mood and the context and the crunch of the old generation of the Exodus. He wants to affirm that every generation of God's people must again get fixed in the context of the Exodus and must stay fixed on that reality. The church shall not be the church unless it enters the new land focused on the Exodus. And from generation to generation, my impression is that the church enters the new land either in terrified timidity or in drooling covetousness. And I have been asking whether it is possible for us who are so fixed in the land to extricate ourselves long enough from our landedness to go again to the boundary and to get a fresh glimpse of who we are. Because I perceive the central battle for the life of the church today to be the battle of our worldview. At the boundary, we decide what we will see when we look. At the boundary, issues are raised about our seduced perceptions, which let us see only what others permit us to see. So at the boundary, every generation, the comfortable and the secure ones like ours, are invited to see the new land through the prism of the Exodus. And I do know about me and about my brothers and sisters that by and large, I live in somebody else's definitional world. And I do see my life day by day through the prism of Pharaoh. And I understand the gospel in Deuteronomy to say, it need not be so for the people of God. So these points occurred to me. If we are to face our seduced perceptions of living in someone else's definitional world, first of all, that it is useful to take a fresh look at the Egyptian Empire, which of course is a model and a paradigm in the Bible for the way the city always tends to organize itself. See Lewis Mumford in his History of the City. Everybody who lived in Egypt knew how it was organized. Not everybody liked it that way, but most everybody assumed that it was going to remain that way, and nobody proposed a realistic alternative. The Egyptian world is organized and made possible and durable through a curious combination of technology and mythology. And I want to suggest that an agenda for the church is to focus on the curious way in which we have joined together a technology and a mythology to keep the city running the way it is running. The technology in Egypt consists in production quotas and budget schemes and process planning and long-range and short-range schedules and market fluctuations and gross national products and building programs and developed sciences. And in that technology, humanness consists in the capacity to tread water fast enough to keep it all running. See Deuteronomy 11. Egypt is a land where you water it by your feet. That may be a euphemism for something else, but that'll do for tonight. And obviously, such a technology depends upon a complex decision-making machinery called bureaucracy and a management class which clearly thinks and has its own jargon about how it will think. See Peter Berger, The Homeless Mind, about the destiny of the bureaucracy. And along with that marvelous technology, Egypt had its own superb mythology. And all mythology is somebody else's theology. A well-developed theology, a system of priests and temples and rites, and at its peak stood Pharaoh, the supreme God, God in the flesh, symbol and embodiment of order, who can say, the Nile is mine, I made it. The mutual service of Egyptian technology and Egyptian mythology was not an accident. The myth provided a context of order, security, and legitimacy, which made the work of techne not only possible, but gave it significance. After all, it was the technology of the king. And the effectiveness of the techne showed the correctness of the myth, because after all, it did work, and people did eat, and the well-off were very well off, and they owned the technology and they governed the mythology. And my judgment is, it is so among us who now belong mostly to the landed in the city. That arrangement, of course, is not exceptional. That is the way of every social order and every social institution. Egypt in the Bible is the embodiment of normalcy. And some get crushed in it, and some only survive, and many prosper, and all belong to each other, and everybody gets their regular payoffs. You know how it was in Egypt. It was 80% for Pharaoh, and 10% for the priests, and 8% for the foreman, and 2% for the slaves, because they got to eat too. And it is probably true that things have not been redivided since then. Now at the boundary, the preacher at the boundary invited Israel to take another peek at Egypt and to look at it through the hole in a brick. Israel, I don't think their bricks had holes in it, but you know what I mean. Israel has an alternative memory of Egypt. And that memory is not about such sophisticated things as technology and mythology. Put very simply, the biblical view of Egypt is that it is a brickyard. It is a brickyard with all the efficiency of technology. It is a brickyard with all the legitimacy of mythology, but it is still a brickyard. It is a brickyard which has been defined as normalcy. Normalcy equals a brickyard, and that is a natural conclusion for people who own and manage the brickyard, and for people who use the bricks, and even for people who make the bricks. And the longer one does what one does in the brickyard, the more normal it seems, because we are all seduced into the definitional world of Pharaoh. But Israel looked more closely, and Israel refused to see Egypt through the prism of Pharaoh. Israel knew that the brickyard is a place of coercion, that is, the power of one exercised over another, that the brickyard is a place of fatigue, not physical exhaustion, but in the words of that noted theologian, Richard Nixon, it is the fatigue of the crisis of the human spirit. And thank God for Richard Nixon, because he called our attention to that phenomenon in our society. The fatigue which is the crisis of the human spirit, because there are no human promises being made there or kept there. And the brickyard, for many of us who are in middle management positions in the brickyard, it is a place of frantic effort to meet the quotas. And of course, they can never be satisfied, because the quotas are always subject to insatiable adjustment. The particular manifestation of that in my life, which may be different from your life, but if you look for it, you will probably locate it, is this anxiety for having published enough articles. And you don't ever publish enough articles, because after you publish one, all they ever ask is, what are you working on now? Which means that the brickyard is a place of inordinate anxiety and finally hopelessness, because there are no alternatives, and technology and mythology serve each other so well. And Rozak and Peter Berger have made it so clear that every dream is finally co-opted, including ours. Now, you know, of course, that the preacher at the boundary is not interested in Egypt. He is interested in Jerusalem. He is interested in the urban culture in Israel, the one that Israel had a chance to organize. He is interested that Israel should look at her land and her city, where she is invited to settle and where she surely will settle. And the preacher at the boundary has the fear that every land and every city is really not different from Egypt. And that's why Egypt can be such a powerful symbol for the world in which we have to try to be men and women of faith. And George Mendenhall has argued with great cogency, I believe, that the new land to which Israel came was a land of aggressive city kings, each of whom had exploited the peasants, who had the technology to oppress and the mythology to legitimate the oppression in terms of the public good. And so I believe the preacher at the boundary wanted Israel to turn back and look at the land again and observe these things, that the prosperous, secure land tends to be organized for the sake of the public order. And as you well know, the temptation of all of us is that as soon as we come into power, we have the temptation to organize it the same way. So I go home weary at 5:30, and I walk in the door, and very soon my wife says to me, "Well, that may be, but you're not Dean here." And the public order which is symbolically legitimated, tends to be indifferent to the crisis of the human spirit. See Earl Butts. And the issue of the crisis of the human spirit, that it can be screened out, is not peripheral, it's not accidental, and it's not incidental, but it is definitional to this particular combination of mythology and technology in the city when it is seen through the prism of Pharaoh. That the issue of the crisis of the human spirit must be programmatically screened out. Now, I believe that is not remote from us, that the people with whom we minister are daily beset with a mythology and a technology that definitionally means to screen out questions of the human spirit. And it follows that questions about the human spirit cannot be raised by clergy, by church people, by believers, without a sharp questioning of the public order, without asking about technology and mythology, and without discerning how they serve each other and whose interests they serve, including our own. And in Egypt, and perhaps in every land, this public order, which combines mythology and technology to screen out the question of the human spirit, finally is defined as normalcy. Now, I believe that I have not departed at all from the book of Deuteronomy. I believe that all of that is expressed and freighted in the heavy word Egypt. Because the word Egypt and the word Pharaoh do not refer to wicked persons and do not refer to corrupt regimes, but they refer to the ontological proportion of power as it squeezes out human value and human hope. Three texts at least suggest that Pharaoh is an ontological principle alive in our world. Isaiah 30 verse 7, Psalm 87 4, and Psalm 89 10. I think in our honesty we know that that's where we live. And what an excitement for those of us who are charged with the office of ministry Sunday by Sunday to get to stand up in front of people and issue a call to worship. What I want to suggest to you is that it is not a call to worship. It is a call to an alternative perception in an alternative history that is characterized by promise. And we may well be the last ones who know that the city is a place where the promise can be articulated. So the point of going to the boundary is to articulate this alternative perception of the city. And so we must tell our children each time, and I hope you are telling yours about this strange incident, you know it well, that the laborers gathered in a little cluster around the intruder, and then some more of them came, and then the foreman got nervous and he sauntered over casually, hoping no one would notice. But everybody always notices where the foreman saunters casually. And he stood on the edge to listen, and then the overseer phoned down to wonder what was going on because the bricks weren't coming through anymore. And right in the center of the brickyard, Moses has articulated an alternative perception of reality. Now think of that. In the brickyard, where everything seemed settled and everything was one way, Moses, who had no credentials and no standing in the mythology or the technology, said there is an alternative way for the city. And in his strange primitive words, the technology is called into question because it ain't worth it. And that question is now alive in the city. And the mythology of the king
is exposed as powerless. And the public order that served both the technology and the mythology is announced to be a fraud, warranting no allegiance. Some of you asked me, after what I said last night, what do you want us to do? And I take refuge in Professor Tillich's words. You just find your own kind of shower and you get wet. What Professor Tillich didn't tell you about that good evangelical shower is that when we were in Heidelberg, we had one of those, and our kids use it, and it is a mess when kids take a situational shower because it's everywhere. So I was glad to come back to America and have a casuistic shower for my kids. What would I have you do? I would have you feel the anguish that I feel about these texts being more radical than I and perhaps some of you are prepared for. That's all. The foreman senses that there's trouble. That's how you get to be a foreman, is to be able to sense it. But he doesn't know what to do. The supervisor is a perfect bureaucrat, and he calls his supervisor. And finally, the chief himself comes. Now, that's a very dramatic moment that this nobody who walked into the center of the brickyard can bring Pharaoh to answer to him. I commend to you Paul Lehman's new book called The Transfiguration of Politics, which is all about Jesus and Pilate and who's on trial. And then, as you know, this narrative evolves into street theater, and Moses and Aaron and the wise men of Egypt sing this little song about anything you can do, I can do better than you. And you know where the sympathy of the workers is located. They watch and they hope and they cheer. And the referee kept saying, if there's any more applause, I will clear the brickyard. And there are these two ways. One is so normal and it is so routine and it is so obvious and it is so royal and it is so standard. And there is this other strange, fanciful proposal, surely not workable. And what the Exodus narrative at the boundary is about is an invitation for God's people to engage in an audacious act of imagination. And you know how it is. It is Moses versus the magicians. It is Yahweh versus Pharaoh. It is let my people go versus make more bricks. And it builds the first time around in Exodus 7:22. I didn't write down what they were, but it doesn't matter what they were. They're all replaceable parts. Moses is so pleased with himself because he turns the water to blood. And Pharaoh says, oh, that's nothing. We do it all the time, and they do it. And then in 8:7, I don't know what the next one is. Is it gnats or whatever it is? And Moses does it, and Pharaoh is unimpressed. And he yawns, and he says, well, we do that too. And then the workers in the brickyard are getting a little bit nervous, because it's bad to be cheering for a rebel if he's a loser. But if you have your Gideon Bible with you from your room, shame on you for having Gideon Bibles in your room. You may want to mark this text. I judge this text to be the most important text in the Bible, which means it's the one we're currently talking about. The third plague, which is the plague about gnats, I want you to get this, reads like this, that Moses and Aaron brought a swarm of gnats. And Pharaoh said, oh, that's nothing. My boys can do it too. And do you know what the text says next? It says, get this, and they could not. Think about that. And you know what the text says next? It says, get this, and they could not. It is the voice of the gospel having made a pronouncement on the technology and the mythology that has organized the city to screen out the question of the human spirit. They could not. And the regime is shown to have lost its power, and the voice of Yahweh had come into the brickyard and had shown that the entire arrangement is without authority, without power, either to make promises or to keep them. And that ripple in the brickyard that day, when they could not, I suppose it began in a subtle secret giggle, and then there was laughter that mocked the empire. And that is the moment that has been entrusted to us, and we must not domesticate it. Who would ever have thought it would happen that the managers who control the forms of public order preside over empty forms that cannot keep their promises? And people in American society are numbed and are waiting, but have forgotten to hope. That reminded me of two texts. One, it's not for nothing in Matthew 23 that Jesus calls the managers of the brickyard white empty sepulchers. The people who control the forms of power have no power. And the other text that may not be related to it, but I thought of it, so I share it with you, is this strange text in Mark 9 where this powerful man comes to Jesus and says, "Help me if you can." And then Jesus makes this enigmatic response, "If I can." And I think those two texts belong together. And they could not. If I can. And at the boundary, the people of God are invited to do incredibly audacious imagining. I want to refer you in that connection to Reuben Alves' book called Tomorrow's Child. He is a battered evangelical pastor in Chile. And it is a word to evangelicals in Chile about how they shall keep their faith in a totalitarian regime. And the root, says he, is audacious imagining. Now I want you to be clear what I'm talking about. I am not doing a critique of an economic system. I am not wanting to urge that the Bible be interpreted in terms of a class conflict. Well, there's an awful lot of data for that. I am not urging or proposing social action or revolution or anything like that. I believe that the central question of the church today has to do with the seduction and domestication of our perception. We get so numbed that we no longer see what is there. We only see what we are trained to see and taught to see and permitted to see. And everything powerful and everything important and everything credible is screened out of our perception. And I believe we may be the last ones in the society that President Herndon was talking about who have a chance to articulate an alternative perception, to see indeed what is there. Because we live so much in the presumptive world that other people have constructed for us. And you Lutherans do take liturgy seriously. Thank God for that. But would it make any difference if we began to see that what liturgy is about is for the hopeless, exhausted people in the city
to participate in the imaginative construction of an alternative life world which the city has said does not exist and may not exist. If that were true, people would live in the brickyard differently. At the boundary, Israel goes to re-enter her memory, to get freed of living in somebody else's presumptive world, to become aware that her perception has been domesticated. And then when she looks from the boundary, I think these are the kinds of things she sees. Last night I talked about the problem of amnesia. Tonight I want to talk about the problem of insanity. At the boundary, when our sons and daughters are reminded one more time about the strange happening in the brickyard where it turned out they could not, we have a hint that normalcy is insane. People who are insane are not sure what is real, and it means they will embrace any fool notion of reality that is submitted to them. It means they will be blown about by any wind of doctrine. It means they will be open to any demonic perception of reality. Have you seen the new Datsun ad? Where one who in mockery wears the color, the garb of our profession, he's got a collar on, and he comes on the screen and he says, "It is the gospel truth that Datsun mileage is better." And then just as the ad is over, down in the corner in parentheses, it says, "Datsun saves." And they could not. Now, by insane, I am no person competent in the field of psychiatry. My mother-in-law is a psychiatrist. She is a 75-year-old Freudian conservative Presbyterian mothering doctor. And she and I have talked theology a great deal, and I've learned a great deal from her, and I was one night sharing with a group that my mother-in-law, who is a psychiatrist, said, and I got no further, and somebody sitting in the audience said, "That is a big deal. Everybody's mother-in-law is a psychiatrist." By insane, I mean such things as living our lives in ways that are utterly incongruous with our deepest values. And our congregations are filled with people who do that. The technical word for that is schizoid. Pursuing courses of action which are utterly without sense in terms of our largest dreams. Insanity is to bow before empty forms of power and expect life to flow from them, which is to appeal to unreality for the gift of reality. Now, it may have been one of the more important moments of sanity in the history of the world in Exodus 8:18, when order that governs is exposed as powerless, and people may go on serving those forms, but they lack power and they warrant no allegiance and they claim no authority. And I've been thinking about people like me and people like you Lutherans who are always confessing our sins, that maybe we ought to take insanity as the central human predicament. So Israel came to the boundary to learn again the moment of sanity that had healed our slave mothers and fathers. And the Exodus memory not only exposes normalcy as insanity, it hints at an alternative way to order society. The Exodus tradition that our mothers and fathers learned about in the brickyard is not interested in coercive objectivity, but believes that freedom Note what Professor Tielecki said, that freedom is a way that the city can be organized. The Exodus tradition of our mothers and fathers who were slaves believes that even a great imperial order, I hope you can make some connections, that even a great imperial order must finally yield to the claims of covenantal existence. The Exodus tradition of our slave mothers and fathers believes that power and healing will not come from scientific capabilities and the powers of prediction, but will come from the stirring of God's newness that will never be domesticated. Now maybe that means, I don't know, maybe that means that Israel could not be in covenant with Yahweh till after she had left Egypt. Isn't that interesting? Exodus before covenant. The Exodus tradition of our slave mothers and fathers believes that the power to heal and the power to liberate are always and inevitably at odds with the power to control and coerce. And Yahweh can never be the patron God for Pharaoh's regime. The Exodus tradition of our slave mothers and fathers believes that while we are so attracted to the way the city is currently organized, it is the power to heal and liberate which will finally have its way in world history, among persons and among institutions and among nations. And all of the Egyptian empires, for all their power, they are not the wave of the future. Now, I'm not talking simply about public ethics. I'm talking about families, and I'm talking about marriages, and I'm talking about all of the seductive power arrangements into which we have fallen. And repentance has to do with the recognition at the boundary that the way we manage things likely will not be the vehicle for God's surging newness among us. Israel goes to the boundary not to rev up for a program. Kings can take care of programs. Preachers at boundaries have other work to do. But so that she does not forget her alternative imagination, to keep vivid her articulation of an alternative vision of how it is promised that it will be. Now I want to comment about Jesus, who is the voice of the sanity of the Exodus at the boundary. Jesus is the new Exodus, who exposed the insanity of his world wrongly organized, and he got himself killed for it. And I want to refer you to that magnificent text in Mark 5 about this demon-possessed man. You know him very well because he is us. And the text begins by that incredible statement that he was chained, and he was such a raving maniac that the chains couldn't hold him anymore. And surely the text means, at least as a side issue, to ask, what kind of a society was it that Jesus came to that took people like that and found it necessary to chain them in the cemetery? He is among the dead. And you know our name. Our name is Legion. You know what Peter Berger says in his book, The Homeless Mind? He says that the necessary condition for bureaucracy and technology to work in American society is that people should be willing to live fragmented lives. And if people ever reject living fragmented lives, the bureaucracy and the technology will disintegrate. And his name is Legion. Because every society's got to have some folks whose name is Legion. And then you know what the text says. I'll skip over the pig incident because I don't know what that means except return the demons to their natural habitat in the sea. And then there is this vision of tranquility. The text says they came to the man They knew he had been with Jesus, and he was clothed in his right mind. It's the only time in the synoptics, plus the parallels, that that word is used. He was with Jesus, and by being with Jesus, had been restored to sanity. And do you know what his neighbors said? They didn't say, "Great, welcome home." They said to Jesus, "Will you please leave before you do that anymore?" An insane society cannot tolerate the eruption of sanity. Now, I think the writer of this gospel had read R.D. Lang. You know R.D. Lang, this British psychiatrist that has spent all of his time working with schizophrenics. And his conclusion is there aren't any schizophrenics who are sick with schizophrenia, but schizophrenia is a program of health for people who have to live in schizophrenic society and can't find any other way to cope with it. Well, take a look at it. One of his books, which makes me very uncomfortable, is called The Politics of the Family, in which he says if you take a schizophrenic out of the family that produced the schizophrenic, the family will disintegrate. That's because I'm not Dean there. And neither are you. Obviously, Mark 5 means to expose the others who object to sanity. And I do not know whether this writer or Jesus had read Peter Berger, but the last piece in the story says he sent him home. At the beginning of the story, the man didn't have a home. The homeless mind. And the sociologists are needing to write more and more about anomy and the homelessness that is among us. And what an incredible thing about the gospel. It is not simply that it sends people home, but it gives people a home who didn't have one, because the world is organized to keep them from having one. It suggested to me about the church that we are enmeshed in and committed to insanity. And we are the kept people who are paid to keep the mythology of the city alive. It suggested to me that we shall not discern sanity until we go to the boundary. It suggested to me that the sanity of the gospel is so radical that it will not be discerned until we dismantle some of the insanity. It suggested to me that the sanity of the gospel, which is nearly more than I can face, is that weakness is the only form of strength, and powerlessness is the only form of power. And you know that the teaching of Jesus is saturated with that, and all of it calls into question the way we have organized the city. I don't even know what it means. But I know I must face it, that the first will be last and the last will be first. And I don't know what the price of oil is all about, but maybe those people in Saudi Arabia are the last ones becoming first. And there are clear implications for us that the humble will be exalted and the exalted will be humbled, and that those who lose their life will find it and those who keep it will lose it, and that the little ones will inherit the kingdom. And he told that story in Luke 7. You know it. Jesus was at the table of a rich man. He at least knew where the good food was. He didn't mind eating off of them. And he always ate before he spoke. That's because he was a wise man. But you know, this nameless woman off the street comes in, and Jesus finds her much more exciting and interesting than his host. And I am sure that the servants around the table snickered, because it was high time the old man got put down by somebody. And he throws a little tantrum, and he said, "Don't you understand who she is? Don't you understand who I am? And don't you know who's paying for this meal? And turn your chair around, because I want to talk with you." And then Jesus is the perfect teacher and never misses the teachable moment and knows that good teaching is always in threes. So he lays three of them out. "When I came in and was thirsty, you didn't give me any water, and she did. And when I came in, you didn't wash my feet, and she did. And when I came in, you didn't kiss me, and she did." The man in the story is surely Pharaoh revisited. And Jesus says very simply, kind of obvious after you've been to the boundary, "I don't know what you're hoping for, but you got everything you're going to get. But this woman is the wave of the future, and power surrounds her life." Well, we are enmeshed in those insanities. It is insane for people like me to eat as well as I do when I know what I know about my brothers and sisters, and I keep doing it. The insanities in our marriage is one of the insanities that we practice in our family. I have a 12-year-old son whom I love dearly. But one of the insanities we practice every afternoon at 5:30 is that we come home and we get into an argument about the television set. And that's just kind of an indoor sport. We both know that we have our role to play, and by dinner time, the whole thing is over with. And we return to our insanity day by day. It is insane for the oil companies, I own stock in one of them, to say in their smugness, "We've never had an inordinate profit yet." It is insane for people like you and me who are self-employed four times a year to mail in our war check. Now, I'm not urging civil disobedience. It may be implied. I'm urging that we have a chance to raise a very different agenda with people at the border, because very many people now are aware of the insanities and are ready to hear some serious talk about sanity. And somewhere it turns up between this statement, "They could not," and "If you can." I want to refer you to a book by a Marxist sociologist called Genovese. Do you know it? It's called Roll, Jordan, Roll. Its subtitle is The World the Slaves Made. And it is a sociological, historical, a sociological analysis of the culture of black slaves in the old South of America. He doesn't use the word alternative. The world the slaves made, the alternative world the slaves made. And he said the two major agents of this alternative world of sanity are the black preachers and the mammies. And the black preachers and the mammies kept announcing to people that they were human, that they had a future and a hope, that they had dignity, and that they didn't finally belong to massa. The thing about that alternative world of imagination is that Whitey couldn't stop it. Whitey didn't even know what was going on, and Whitey couldn't get in it. And every day, these black slaves had to get up and go pick cotton in this insane world one more time. But every night they came back to their real world, where their human dignity was announced to them again. And this author says that was a delicate line to have to live on, because if they went just too far, Whitey owned all the guns and they would have been killed. See Nat Turner. Now it may be that Pharaoh in our society owns all the guns. But we have an alternative world of sanity that has been entrusted to us, and it might finally change the city. I've been thinking about me and my colleagues where I worship on Sunday morning. Wouldn't it be neat if we shaped that Sunday morning with the understanding that we are the people in the city who have come to plead temporary sanity? Will I elaborate on my statement that the sanity of the gospel will not be heard until the insanity of, what did I say, the brickyard, is dismantled? Well, I meant simply to be saying that I believe before Moses could say, come to freedom with Yahweh, to Sinai, the covenant, he first had to make it clear that Pharaoh's forms of power were without validity. And that as long as I still am convinced about the validity of Pharaoh's forms of power, I cannot really hear any alternatives. That's what I meant to suggest.
Chapter is fantastic when you lecture like that. I think any questions are just necessary.
Well, I see no other hands anyway.